fluorescent signal.
Okay. So thank you to the organizers for having invited me here. And actually, I will talk, part of the time I will take talking about this, and since Daniel Mack was talking about his experimental observations on the IP3 receptor, and we also developed some model for that, I will talk about that later. And well, the talk I'm going, this first part about the fluorescent signals, the work was mostly done by Alejandra Ventura and Luciana Bruno. Alejandra is a graduate student in Buenos Aires, and Luciana is a postdoc. And we've applied the technique to some experiments that Angelo De Muro and Ian have done on voltage-gated channels. And well, I liked the idea of Ian of showing pictures. I don't have a picture of the individual people, but I have a collective picture. So this is Alejandra, and this is Luciana. And then the work on the IP3 receptor is work with Daniel that is there. And then John is talking about something that Bernardo was involved with. So they are kind of in there. Anyway, so we've seen in this meeting a bunch of experiments in which calcium is observed using these optical techniques, in which you use a fluorescent dye, and it's relatively non-invasive. However, there is a, well, this is some observations by Ian, and the experiments, as Ian explained, most of them are done photo-releasing IP3 and then waiting until you see some calcium signal. And if you want to have relatively good time resolution, you do a line scan so you have information only about one spatial dimension. And these plots are space-time plots. And so most of the plots I'm going to show have this type of structure. And although these techniques are non-invasive, one of the problems is that it's difficult to infer what is the calcium current that gives rise to those signals that you observe in the experiment. And the problem, one of the reasons for that difficulty, is the fact that calcium does not diffuse freely in the cytosol, and we've seen that in this meeting. So diffusion is affected by reactions with buffers. And in particular, the fluorescent indicator is a calcium buffer. And actually, what you see is not free calcium concentration, but the distribution of calcium bound to the indicator. And there are other mechanisms that also affect the dynamics. Maybe some of them are slow, and you can expect that they don't affect too much your calculations, like pumps or other means by which calcium is removed from the cytosol. But anyway, it's not that easy to have a quantitative information of all these processes that affect the dynamics of calcium once it's released into the cytosol. And so it's difficult to determine both the current, the amplitude of the current, and also the time course of the current. And well, different methods have been proposed. In particular, well, one of the ideas of Ian's was to generate simulated paths, micro-injecting calcium in the cytosol and comparing the signals that you could get injecting calcium with the pipette with the signal that you get by photoreleasing IP3, so the IP3 evoked signals. But the problem with this method is that still the part of the current that corresponds to calcium is not known. And so you can compare the figures, but you don't know exactly how much calcium you're injecting there. And so then, well, these experiments with individual voltage-gated calcium channels could provide also a means to compare your signals, and because these channels, you can know what the current is through an individual channel, and so since you have that more or less known, you can compare what you see when calcium enter through one of these voltage-gated calcium channels with the signal that you get in other conditions, and use that as a means to calculate what's the current. But in any case, it's still of interest to determine if you have an experiment, what is the current, that is, how much calcium is entering and with what kind of time course. And so, yes.
These optical methods are really detecting density.
Mm-hmm.
So why do you always use the term current as opposed to just density? Is it the same thing, or is there?
No. Well, you detect the distribution of the calcium concentration in space and time.
Right.
Actually, you detect
density.
Density. It's the same. And actually,
confused by the.
Well, no. The thing is, you have a source of calcium. I mean, you release IP3, and that opens these channels. You don't know how many channels you open. You don't know how much time they are open. And so you would like to get that information. You would like to know, I see this signal, which is a consequence of the opening of these channels. How many channels opened up? For how long? And so that, the number of channels and the time course, gives you the influx of calcium into the region that you're looking at. And that's what we are trying to determine. That stuff.
But when you're relating it to experiments,
mm-hmm.
you're relating it to experiments on concentration.
Yeah.
And I mean, when you pointed to these things, you said, well, this is the current, and that I found confusing.
No. That's.
If you emphasize the temporal aspect of it, that you have a concentration change with time, then there's a sort of a current thing.
I mean, if you didn't have. Now, the thing is. But what I didn't mean that what we observed was the current. What I mean is, if there were no current, you wouldn't see anything.
Remember that there are steps between mm-hmm. what is observed and what you're talking about.
Okay. So what we want to get to is to obtain the cause of what we are observing, basically. So anyway, so I'm going to show a little bit of a method that was published in this paper. And well, in this paper, several methods are proposed, but the one that can be applied to experiment is the one that is called FBA. And this is a method that was applied not to calcium puffs, so not to release through IP3 receptors, but to calcium sparks, so they release through ryanodine receptors. And in all these methods that were proposed in this paper, there were three main steps. First, obtain the calcium dye distribution from the fluorescence, which you need to have some information on the fluorescent indicator. Then, once you have the distribution of calcium bound to dye, you try to get the distribution of free calcium concentration. And then, in these methods, in order to compute what they call the flux, which is this QCA, they use an equation of this type because they have the distribution of calcium as a function of space and time. Ideally, if you could follow all the previous steps, this is some things that are bound to calcium. And the thing is that you need to know all the details of the processes that affect the calcium temporal evolution in the cytosol. So you need the off and on rates of calcium binding with the endogenous buffers, and you need to know what's their distribution. Well, you need to know a lot of things, and usually that's not so simple. And well, in this method, they've done some numerical tests simulating numerically a spark, and then try to use their algorithm to reconstruct. And well, they got a linear relationship between the actual current of the simulation and the current of the reconstruction method. Is more or less. Well, it depends on if you use this one or this one. I don't remember the difference. But it's kind of 16 goes to 8, so it's kind of, you get double, 100% error in the current estimate here. Anyway, so, well, okay, you want to ask something?
No.
Oh, okay, so there are other methods in which what you do is you put together a model and you generate a path with your model and try to compare. You can compare like by naked eye or try to get more quantitative comparisons. But still, for all these things, you... Yes, well, in this paper, they don't use a detailed model of the release. They see if it's open for a certain amount of time and then decays with a certain time course. They try to reproduce the form. This is the experiment and this is the simulation.
Well, the model that they calculate the concentration of buffer-bound calcium.
Yes. And then, well, you also, I mean, these methods have a lot of other sophisticated things, like, for example, blurring your image, because when you observe, I mean, your experiment does not give you the exact concentration, gives you something that is a little blurred. You cannot focus exactly on a plane. Well, all that stuff, you can convolute your simulations with what you expect from the microscope. And I mean, it's not plain.
No, there are the buffers and there are the dyes. So the dyes model is another buffer. That one, which is another buffer.
Yes, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
But it still assumes 15 or 20 or 30 free parameters.
You need extra, because the cytosol has other buffers. And that's what is hard to know. If it were only the dye, it wouldn't be that difficult, I guess. So, these methods usually need this. A detailed model, and what we tried, and these detailed models require a lot of information that is not always available, and so we tried to develop some model that, well, not a model, we tried to develop a technique that could extract the most possible information from the experiment without making too many assumptions about what's going on there. And I'm going to give a little bit of what my inspiration was, but which comes from my background, basically. And my inspiration came from some techniques applied to chaotic dynamical systems, and which was something that had a lot of activity around in the 80s, in which basically the idea was that if you have an experiment and you have a single measurement and you get a time series, still from that time series you can get information of, even if it's just a scalar, since you have it as a function of time, you can get information of the multidimensional dynamical system that is generating this time series. And well, at the beginning, mainly these type of techniques were used to obtain some statistics about the dynamical system, but later it was also used to obtain equations that could give you, so vector fields basically, that could give you describe the evolution of the variable that you were measuring. So the idea here is if you have a long enough time series, that is generated by an autonomous system, then you observe for a sufficiently long time, you can predict what's going to happen next, provided that your series is stationary in a way, so that you get the information of how things evolve during a certain time, and then you use that to predict how it's going to evolve later on. And as I told you, with many time series, they were able to write down equations, given that you measured one variable that was u, you could write down a set of equations that gives you an evolution for the measured variable that is the one that you measured within a certain error. And so the idea is that you use what you measure to construct a system that predicts how this variable is going to vary with time. Yes. What question?
Well, maybe philosophical one.
Okay.
Those methods work well when you have a system that's almost completely deterministic, where noise is not relevant, where there's no, where there's only chaos but no noise. Now, in the openings of the channels, I think most people believe that it's at least to some degree stochastic. So, are you going to tell us how these?
Well, what I am going, the thing is, I don't think that with this method, I mean, you have to look at each individual opening. And so, what I guess, well, it's once it's given, I mean, it's injecting, the calcium is getting into the cytosol, I wouldn't say it's deterministic exactly, but
I think one could argue that the main effect of stochasticity
is the beginning, it's the trigger.
And she's not predicting the trigger.
And, well, and actually,
how it will go on.
But that assumes that during the course of a puff, a fixed number of channels are either open or closed.
Yes.
Whereas my vision of
yeah.
a puff is
yeah.
that
true.
But let,
in the course of a puff, channels could be opening
and okay.
closing.
But I think I know how to answer that. Actually, what we are going to do is, with this method, try to infer in which way the dynamics is affected by the processes that you don't know. And so all the stochasticity is in the mostly in the current, which is what you're trying to determine, but not in the way the other processes work. And that's what we are going to try to infer with this method.
Okay.
Yeah, no, it's fine. Anyway, so basically the idea, it's not perfect, but... Well, I don't know, we are happy, but... Anyway, so basically what this says in these deterministic things is the information is in the time series. And so, what can we get from the experiments with fluorescent indicators? So we have the image because calcium binds to the indicator. We assume the simplest possible kinetics for the binding. F is the fluorescent indicator, this is free calcium, this is calcium bound to the indicator. And in the experiments that we apply this to, the indicator is fluo4. And then with other experiments that used other indicators in which the basal fluorescence and the maximum fluorescence doesn't spread much, the method doesn't work. I mean, we had problems trying to use it with other indicators, but with fluo4, it was fine. And so you can relate, given that you know all these parameters that characterize how the indicator works, given the distribution of the fluorescence, you can get the distribution of calcium bound to the indicator. And so if we can do that, then basically we have the distribution of calcium bound to the indicator. Now, there is a problem, which is we only have information on one space direction. And so here is one of the assumptions, which is that what we get from that one direction that we observe is the same in all other directions, which would be okay if we have a very localized source and that we are going with the line scan exactly through the source. I mean, if we have some offset, then we break the symmetry. But, well, then we are trying to see what happens if we assume that there is an offset. Anyway, so if we know all the distribution of calcium bound to the indicator at the parameters of the indicator, etc., and the indicator only binds to calcium, then this is the evolution for calcium bound to the indicator. And therefore, since we know this for all, given that we assume this spherical symmetry, we know this for all times and space that has been measured. And so we can calculate derivatives. And that's another problem of the method, that you need to calculate derivatives, and that introduces errors. And if we could calculate that exactly, then by calculating all these terms, we could get the distribution of free calcium from the distribution of calcium bound to the indicator. And so ideally we have now a series of the free calcium concentration as a function of time and space. And that's what we are going to yes.
I mean, there is a problem of principle though, and that is that the instructions don't work for partial differential equations. They only work if you have a small number of variables, and this has an infinite number of variables.
Yes.
That's a problem of principle. No one has ever done a reconstruction with more than
I understand.
Six variables, even if six variables, and this is
PDEs.
A PDE.
I understand.
And
now,
so you really want to look at average spatial averages and see to what extent the spatial averages have a dynamics that you can model. I mean, this is apart from all the assumptions. Simplifications,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's a fundamental problem with reconstructing PDEs, and I don't understand.
Well, what I think is I understand that it's infinite dimensional, but there is a what happens at a particular space and time doesn't depend on what happens very far away on time or very far away on space. There is a limitation of how things are coupled. So there is a finite correlation, and that's what I expect that can help me get something.
Well, let's talk about it.
Okay.
I think there's a problem of principle here.
But do you really want to construct a PDE or just that one field out of it? I mean, she doesn't really want to reconstruct.
But a field is an infinite number of variables.
No.
Absolutely not. Okay, well, we'll talk about it later. But I don't know.
I mean, I am not presenting a proof.
No.
I am presenting something. I am presenting something that it seems to work. So, to infer this current, of course there is error. The thing is that it gives you some information on how much calcium is entering into the cytosol and with which time course.
Is that in a scalar time series?
Okay.
Anyway, so basically one funeral here. The experiments use the fluorescent indicator F, and then some of the experiments use EGTA, which is this E, and you know how much UGTA you injected and also the indicator. So there are parts of the evolution equation of the calcium concentration that you know. Then there is an unknown zone, and then there is the source that you're after. And so the idea is to make an ansatz for this unknown zone based on what you measure. And the so this unknown thing, we write it as a function. We make the like a first order approximation, sort of, because we assume it's a function of calcium, the first time derivative, and up to second order derivatives in space, with, I mean, keeping the things that can keep the symmetry that we assumed. And so, basically what we have is, we assume that the evolution for the calcium concentration everywhere is stuff we know, stuff we don't know that we write as an, we put an ansatz for that, and the source that is what we want to get. And so what we are assuming basically is that all this stuff that we don't know can be written as the same function. It has always the same functional form everywhere in your record, the same functional form as the function of concentration and derivatives. And
this is not identical to the message we presented to us.
No. The, I don't know which method.
Now you assume a term for buffers, diffusion, then a temporal derivative.
But I don't assume anything for this. I don't put any parameters. I'm going to, I am not saying there are all these buffers, writing expressions for this. What I am assuming is that all those interactions, since couple the, what you measure at this particular space and time to what you measure at previous times and nearby points, I am going to write it as a function of the concentration at this space and time and the derivatives, which gives you the coupling to previous times, and space derivatives that gives you how nearby points affect your dynamics. So I'm not writing an explicit expression for this, saying I assume these many buffers with these kinetics or whatever. I'm going to get an expression from the experiment. Pardon me?
It doesn't contain 43 parameters from some complicated model.
So you don't assume a power, those are known.
No.
You're trying to deduce that from...
Yes, what I'm saying is, whatever, if you assume that there is only buffers, for example, but there are, I don't know, a lot of buffers, and all of them have this dynamics that is usually assumed. And so this is going to be the sum of a bunch of terms that depend on concentrations of other variables that are evolving in time. So you don't have a closed equation for calcium. You have these coupled to the evolution equations for all the rest. All those things, instead of having all that coupled system, I am replacing that by this type of term, saying all those interactions can be thought of. I mean, how to say this?
No, but it's typically done. Okay, so people write some buffer dynamic expressions, but they don't specify the parameters. Yeah, and then from the data, they somehow more or less reliably fit the parameters.
That could be, but that assumes that you need to know what are the buffers.
The only difference I see is that typically a sort of structure for the T term is assumed, and you just drop the assumption of the structure of this T term.
Yeah, but the assumption of the T term that is usually assumed involves coupling these to a zillion equations, and now I'm closing this. I don't need to couple these to a zillion equations for buffers. I am getting a closed equation for the calcium concentration and pulling out only the stuff that we do know for sure, which is what is injected. That's the thing.
It's like an adiabatic elimination, I think, of the, of the buffers.
If you know the parameters of this term, you know the
you don't.
You know the dynamics of the buffer, the quality stress, and the dynamics of stress.
And she's not assuming she knows them.
I am trying to get it from the experiment, basically. So, now, one of the things that is important is in that in all these experiments, the source is localized. So there is a region where there is no source. And in that region, then, we can get, try to fit this T by this equation. Because you know the calcium concentration, you can calculate all these terms. So you can fit the functional form of this T. Anyway, so the form that we assume is this thing. It's just a combination of a function of calcium that we want to compute times the first derivative in time, a function of calcium times the gradient squared, and so on. And so now I will try to. Well, I will go back to explaining a little bit more detail how we do that. But basically, if we have T as a function of concentration and derivatives, you put this now in the region where there is source, and you can get the source from here. So I'm going to describe how the method goes in a little more detail. And basically, there are some experiments that will be used only to obtain the expression for T, but for which you won't be able to infer the calcium current, which are the experiments for which the signal is the largest. So suppose we have, this is a numerical simulation, but suppose it's an experiment. And so we have two experiments. And what we have is the fluorescence. So, and this is, again, space and time. And with the color code, we indicate the level of fluorescence. So you have the fluorescence, and the first... The concentration of fluorescent indicator? Well, no, of the fluorescence, which is... something, how many photons you're counting, basically. And then from here to here, you go to the concentration of the dye bound to calcium using the information on how the indicator works. So the first step is going to that. And then we go to the calcium concentration. It's the following step, which implies knowing how the indicator binds to calcium. And, well, here is the distribution of the calcium concentration. And now the thing is, we will assume that the source is mainly located in the region with the largest calcium concentration. And so we are going to use the fitting procedure outside of that region where we are expecting to have the source. And that's what this grid is trying to explain. So we are considering only the data points outside of the region where we think the source is. And this is a gross grid point. We use a finer one, but it's just a cartoon picture. And so now, since we need to obtain four functions, we need at least two data, four functions, we need at least four data points per each value, and what we want to get is four functions of calcium. So for each calcium value, what we do then is we grid the values of calcium concentration. So here we had from a minimum value to a maximum value of calcium. Well, we are going to bin that and consider, I don't know, 100 values of calcium. And so we look at each of these grid points and look what the calcium concentration is, and we put it in one of those bins. And once we have that, well, we need at least 4 grid points that go into one of these calcium bins to be able to infer the 4 calcium functions that we want. And so this is a histogram of how many bins or how many grid points correspond to a particular value of calcium. And the largest calcium concentrations have very few data points. And so there is a region beyond which you cannot do the fitting. And so then, once you have this binning of the calcium concentration, and you have all these grid points, in which for each of these grid points, you can write down the equality that your unknown function, T, is something that you do know. It's written in terms of the derivative and of the binding to the fluorescent indicator, and etc. All the things that you can calculate from the experiment, you have T. And what we want to do is write T as this function of calcium times the first derivative, etc., etc. And you do know this. So what you have is these unknown functions that need to make this equality be possible. And you have many of these equalities. For each value of calcium in that bin, you have as many equalities as grid points correspond to that value of calcium. And so then you do some standard thing to compute the functions. And so here is the 4 functions as a function of the, these are the points that are obtained by the fitting procedure. And these are some functions that can approximate them for the 4 functions. And once you have that, then you have an expression for T. But of course, you have an expression that is good within the region of calcium concentrations for which you could apply this fitting procedure. So it doesn't include the very large calcium concentrations. And that's why you cannot go back and get the source here. But you can go back and get the source there. And this is what we get. And so in this simulation, for example, this is the flux over the maximum flux in the numerical simulation, and this is in the reconstruction. And
the reconstruction turns on early.
I don't know how to go back. Oh, that was a miracle. Do you think? Yeah. There is a little bit.
You're gridding in time.
Yes.
So is that one time?
Time step? I don't know. I don't know. Anyway, so what I'm going to show now is some applications. So this is again, well, this is the one that I've just shown. And before I showed you the flux that we got divided by the maximum value, so there was a little bit of cheating. Here I show you the actual thing we get. We get an overestimate of the calcium current, although in this case it's not that bad. This is the flux in micromolar. Let me see, I don't see it. Because this is not exactly the current. This is the flux through a surface. So it's a current per unit area. And I don't see the units. I don't see them. This is a 5 picoamp current that we used over a 1 micron radius. So you can figure out what the flux is. And anyway, the time behavior is pretty good. And this is the results from several simulations, and including the error bars that come from all the derivatives that we take, the fitting, etc. And so here is the current. These are all for numerical simulations with a source that was like a sphere, basically, of a certain radius and different amplitudes. And so this is the one that the algorithm gives, and you can fit it by a more or less a straight line, whose slope is 1.15, so it's kind of 15% error. This is very good. This is with simulations, so it's like
you have a simulation, and then how do you generate the
fluorescence?
The fluorescence using the simulation.
Assuming that it's the fluorescent behaves in the way that we think it behaves.
Okay, so you actually use an equation for the dynamic equation.
We use it. Well, what we do is we integrate the equation for the calcium concentration in the presence, here in the presence of dye, the source, and I think nothing else. And in others, we did with EGTA. This is a current that is constant during a certain amount of time, and then it's turned off.
You actually using this in a just an EGTA buffered bath, basically.
Yeah. What we want to do is to test if the method works in a situation in which we have absolute control, because we generated it.
You know everything.
We know everything. And so it's easy to compare. Yeah.
Do you have an estimation of the calcium current which stands for properties of
the dye? No, I think it's due to properties of the method. And I think it's because, I mean, we are assuming that term that we are trying to fit depends only on first derivatives, and that if we kept higher derivatives so that we go like further away in the memory of the system, both in time and in space, that the method should be better. Although I don't know. Pardon me?
The noise and stuff will start to bite.
Yeah. Yes.
As though if a t equals a constant zero would give you the correct answer. Because in your model, you don't have anything that's not in your. What should be in the key term? What would be that solution of what you tested? Because I didn't hear that you said anything. It should be any of those.
In that simulation, now let me go back to the. Now I don't remember what the simulation had. This had EGTA. And what I don't know is if the EGTA was. I think that the EGTA was not pulled out of the. Was not pulled, I mean, it was not included into the known terms in this simulation. Yeah, it was just a dye. Yes. Okay, so, well, then there is the problem of what happens if your experiment does not go through the point where calcium is being released, but you're doing your light scan here, and here is where the current is being released. And so you have an offset. And so we added an offset. I mean, we made a simulation, and then we assumed that what we were observing didn't go through the point of release. And we compared for various offsets. And since we are overestimating the current, if we have an offset, we get better. Because, and this is various offsets and the errors that we get. But we always get a linear relationship, and the errors here are not very bad. Then what we did was apply it to a situation in which several openings occurred in a row, and here the current was slightly worse. I mean, the slope is 1.4 and 1.5, but we get pretty good the openings and closings. So the time course is captured pretty well by the method.
So what's the screen?
This is the, you can see there. Well, I don't know if this is the calcium bound to the indicator. I think so. And this is the time.
No,
this is the flux. So this is the reconstruction. What we get for the flux as a function of time and as a function of space.
There are three graphs at the bottom. What's the difference between them?
Oh, this is what happens when, what information you get from this, what information you get from this one, and what information you get from this one, for several experiments in which this corresponds to the first opening, and we did it for different currents, and so on. Anyway, and then we tried with other time scales, like exponential decay, and we were trying to see if we could capture the decay time of the current, and this is the ratio between the real decay time of the exponential decay in the current and the one we get from the algorithm, and we get something that is, the ratio is around 0.9, basically, for different currents. And, well, this is for the amplitude. I think I will skip some of these. And so then, finally, we applied it to real experiments, which are these experiments in which calcium enters through voltage-gated channels that are in the plasma membrane, and where you can look at individual channels. And the type of calcium channel is an N-type, and so there is some information of how it behaves from other types of experiments. And so this is the experimental record there. And in that experimental record, we had first two openings here, and then kind of three. And we applied the method to those two set of observations. So this is kind of similar to what we tried to simulate the last one that you asked me about. And so here is the calcium bound to the indicator, which is called B in this figure. And this is the flux. And so, oh, I thought I had something else.
You said that you can go quite a lot of smoothing on the raw data before deriving the calcium bound buffer.
I think the smoothing is mainly for the figure. I think they kept the raw data for the calculations. But this, I don't remember how much smoothing there was. And these two traces, this is the, what we reconstruct, the solid trace, basically, is what we get as the current, or as a function of time. Flux. And the light one is the calcium bound to the indicator. So to show that we get kind of with the method, we see that it closes before and then there is a tail because of calcium diffusion, basically, in the signal. And so we can single out the time scale of the current. Anyway, so then the calcium current, you were saying that it's most in using electrophysiology, is not, calcium is not used as the ion carrier because it's difficult to measure, it's too small, the current.
In the solid barium to increase
current. Yeah, and so they are not, there are expected values for the what the calcium current would be, but it's not that it's no exactly. Is that right?
It's too small for us.
Okay, but it's expected to be less than 0.2 picoamps. And what we get from, this is an average of the time course of the current over seven individual events, and we get a maximum current of 0.18. And then the time scale also was within what is expected for these openings that are not too brief, that are the ones that you can capture with the method.
Well, the top of that graph, 7 events, how are you?
You have to, yeah, you have to align.
Open,
yeah.
Instantly at the same time. You're aligning to the beginning or
yes,
the middle?
Yes, I think it's to the beginning.
Yeah. So then there's a spread of
Getting
on 20 seconds,
which shouldn't be there. Yeah, there should be some error bars, I guess, there. Anyway, so this is a summary. And basically, what we tried to do was to build a method that could be model independent to infer the calcium current so that it could get the most out of the experimental data. And we applied it to some numerical simulations, and we got this overestimate of the current. And we looked at different currents with different timescales, and the timescales were captured even better than the current. And then we applied it to these voltage-gated calcium channel experiments, getting values that seem to be within those that are expected. And I don't know. I was thinking of talking about something else, but I don't know. Do you think so? I don't know. So.
You started how long?
Well, no, it's not going. No. It's not going to be an hour. This is short. So I just wanted to comment a little bit on a model that we developed for the IP3 reset with Daniel Freiman. And basically, the motivation was some puzzling observations, at least puzzling for us, that the open probability as a function of cytosolic calcium looked very... Oh, I made a mistake on the year here. This is 98. The observed by Vesprosvani and Ehrlich using reconstituted bilayers was very different for the same amount of IP3 than the one observed by Mack et al. In the native membrane of the nucleus doing patch clamp. And so we were wondering what was causing that. And in principle, you can think of several explanations. And you can say, well, they are different cell types. They are different experimental protocols. And maybe you lose some accessory proteins and the gating changes. But that's kind of, I would say, a pessimistic point of view, because if things are so dependent on the experiment, then it would be very difficult to withdraw much of a conclusion. And so we tried to take a more optimistic approach, I guess. And when we saw these experiments by Daniel Mack, which over here I don't have only the experiments, I also have the curves of his model. So the solid lines are the curves of his model, and the points are the experimental data points. And these are experiments in which the calcium luminal that is used is ultra low. And they see that this open probability up to 1 millimolar of cytosolic calcium doesn't go down. And so if you put together these three pictures and you look at what's the calcium luminal that is used, here is very high, here is smaller, and here is even smaller, it seems like you can have a continuous change in your behavior. So from something that goes like this to something that goes like this, to something that goes like this as you decrease luminal calcium. And so what we did basically was to develop a method, a model that had, in which gating of the channel was affected by calcium luminal. So it had a luminal calcium binding site. And there are a bunch of other observations that point to the effect of luminal calcium on the behavior of the channel. And one that I would, there are two that I want to comment on. One is a paper by Besprosvani and Ehrlich, in which they used different divalent carriers. And so on the what would be the luminal side, they have different divalent ions. And when they have calcium on that side, the mean open time of the channel is smaller than when they have magnesium or other divalent ions. And so there are differences in the open probability too. And this is another paper. Here is the reference. And actually in this paper, they don't look just at the type 1 IP3 receptor, but also type 2, but I won't look at this. So if we look at the type 1 IP3 receptor, this that dotted line is Besprosvani. And this solid line is the records they obtain. And they do the experiments using reconstituted bilayers. And one of the differences with respect to Besprosvani's experiment is the amount of luminal calcium that is lower in this experiment than in Besprosvani and Ehrlich. So we were expecting that the open probability would be larger if luminal calcium went down. And this is basically the model. We tried to accommodate other data, and that's why we put all these states. Pardon me? In the Ramos-Franco paper? I think it's 250 nanomolar. Oh, it's there. 250 nanomolar. It was, 50 millimolar of calcium something. So, but it's very high. In that experiment of 91, yes.
Actually, they were using EGTA, which is slow, and they were using the same buffer, as far as I can tell from the paper, over a wide range of cytotoxic calcium concentrations. So I'm not sure. They never mentioned whether measuring the actual calcium concentration. So all the calcium concentration that they use presumably is actually calculated from the software based on how much chelator and how much.
Do you remember how much EGTA they have?
One half to 1 millimolar, I think, somewhere in that range, I think.
What millimolar EGTA? You said I must not get a buffer or anything.
Yeah, I know. I think I don't remember exactly, but my impression is that their concentration of EGTA is not that much higher than our concentration of BAPTER, actually, so that's...
But I mean, that was the interpretation they placed on the strontium, barium, and calcium data, that it was coming through the channel and exercising its effect on mean open time because it was unbuffered at the cytosolic side.
Yeah, in this paper, they do a more...
Cytosolic inhibition. Right. And those observations fitted with the known effects at the cytosolic, so it's not to say there weren't other effects too, but the relative lack of effect of barium was consistent with barium having rather little effect from the cytosolic side. So it fitted with that interpretation that it's exactly as you're suggesting. Unbuffered on the cytosolic side. Mm-hmm.
So it may not be necessarily a little bit more.
No, it's not the only explanation possible. But
experiments other than those of Besprosvani have calcium levels below maybe at the lunar binding site. So in these papers, you can imagine that that site loses calcium, whereas in that Besprosvani, the calcium would be contained on the way.
I don't know. Well, so the KD of the luminal site.
That all comes from looking at fragments of proteins with all the reservations that there are about whether that's a true reflection of how it behaves in the native setting. So,
So what we did was just to think if there is a luminal calcium binding site without any a priori value for the affinity. if we could fit all these observations, basically. And so the model, it has two branches that are similar, and we put two branches to accommodate some other observations, actually. But basically, the idea, it's a sequential model. So even if we add, if we compare this, for example, with the Dyang-Kaiser model, in which you have, for each subunit, three binding sites, if we added one-fourth binding site for luminal calcium, then it would have many more states. But if we assume that only some transitions are allowed in some sequential way, you have a simpler model, and you have many fewer parameters to fit. And so we assume that there are two calcium binding sites on the cytosolic side and one IP3, like in the Dyang-Kaiser, but they are not all of them exposed simultaneously for binding, and that there is a luminal binding site. And mainly what we also, another thing we did was we didn't assume that the channel changed conformation immediately upon ligand binding, but that there was some delay. And so, for example, here you have IP3 bound and calcium bound to the activating site on the cytosolic side, is that? And after that, with some transition probability, you open the channel. And so here is the luminal site. And only once the luminal site is occupied, you have the binding site for calcium that inhibits the channel, or that can close the channel, be there. So what we've done here is the inhibition of the channel via cytosolic calcium depends hierarchically on the luminal calcium. So if you have a lot of luminal calcium, you will be able to inhibit more easily than if you have less luminal calcium. That's the idea of the model, basically. And so these are some results. What we did, we calculated stationary open probability, but we also did stochastic simulations. And so these are stationary open probabilities for various values of IP3 and 300 nanomolar luminal calcium. And then, so this would be, of course, we don't reproduce exactly the shape of the open probability, but we reproduce some important qualitative behavior, I would say. Pardon me? What?
If bang equals is C, it's not equal.
What is equal? Oh, this is different from. Yeah. Okay. Okay, I'm sorry. I don't know. I didn't write that. Anyway, so this is what we get for the ultra-low luminal calcium, that we see an open probability that stays there. And these are the experimental data point of Daniel and Kevin Foskett. And then, well, these are some predictions of the model, actually, because, I mean, what we've done here is change in luminal calcium. So these are different values of luminal calcium from smaller to larger. And what we see is that the open probability for very low cytosolic calcium, this is cytosolic calcium, gets larger as you increase luminal calcium. And this sort of agrees in a very qualitative way. Well, these are the data of Bespros-Vanni. Okay, so first.
What do you think about the ability of the luminal site when you set those concentrations?
You know, I don't remember the numbers. I don't remember the numbers. And now, here, but I can look at them and tell you. So here what we see is that by changing luminal calcium, you go from more of a squarish kind of open probability as observed here, This is the same amount of IP3. I think it's 10 micromolar IP3, or 1 micromolar. I don't remember now. And then as you increase luminal calcium, the open probability goes down, like in the case of Bezprosvani. And the other thing that I was pointing at was this, that here is increasing the open probability for a fixed value and low value of cytosolic calcium that seems to agree very qualitatively with some observations with other types of experiments in which they observe that if the stores are fully loaded, you don't need that much cytosolic calcium to evoke release. And then another things that we compared were mean open times. We tried to reproduce that because we not only looked at the stationary probability but also at mean open times. And well, we found that mean open times for higher luminal calcium were smaller than for smaller. So basically, this is what I want to tell about this model.